For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kim Blanford. In the cave with me, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever likely to come across, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle. Gentlemen, it just takes 2 seconds to look at the news and realize that sometime today, someone else is going to get charged or accused of sexual harassment or some kind of conduct that we would consider to be maybe amoral, definitely an ethical violation. Guys, where does the ethical line come from? Where do we start when we're trying to define morals?
Yeah, you know, Tim, we started this show off with the idea that we were going to kind of look beneath the headlines and try to look at sort of the philosophical background. And it's hard not to look at the headlines and not see that they're really dominated these days by men behaving badly. I think that would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah. Yeah. Deplorable. Let's spend our time together on this program today with a look at ethics. Ethics is a branch of philosophy, philosophy being the love of wisdom, and ethics is really the inquiry into moral action,
right
as moral agents. And so there's, and then we'll try to apply it maybe into some of the shenanigans and deplorable behavior that we're seeing.
Well, I guess let's start with looking at some of the deplorable action. And one of the interesting things, to me at least, is that in today's day and age where there's so much, I'll use Alistair MacIntyre's term, incommensurability of ethical views. In other words, it's really hard to get people to sit down and agree on what's right, what's wrong, etc. These actions are things that are pretty universally condemned. I mean, you're going to have to look far and wide to find somebody that says that what's going on and what's dominating the headlines, that, oh, no, that's really okay.
Yes. Well, it's because, and I would agree, because there is a prevailing ethical standard or ethos that's out there that some of these very famous Hollywood and television personalities have violated. And I would say that what we're left with right now are the prevailing ethical standard for sexual conduct, at least, or much of moral conduct, is it's choice and it's autonomy. So choice also seen as what? Consent. So as long as I'm choosing actions that I'm as long as adults are consenting to act certain actions or inactions, then it's okay. It's okay. They get because it really doesn't quote unquote harm anyone else. So this is why you see, I think, why the headlines are full of these charges and then admissions too, right? Admissions to wrongdoing by it seems to be all men at this point who have abused their positions by violating the consent of another with unwanted sexual actions.
Right. And, even when you're looking at it in the workplace, I think you start to wind up with always around ethics, there seems to be some sort of ethical calculus going on. And so in this case, the ethical calculus seems to revolve around that notion of consent and where can consent actually be given? What are the power dynamics of a working relationship with somebody to where, there is no possibility for consent? Unfortunately, in some of the headlines, you're dealing with age. And so then there's the question too, at what age age can somebody freely give consent? So you wind up with all of these kind of questions around ethics, but they are, you're right, they all go back to that central question of autonomy and consent. And so, you know, that's not quite how the church thinks about these things necessarily. Obviously, autonomy and consent are important considerations within the moral framework of the church. But where did this whole notion of conscience and consent and autonomy being the kind of prime driving factor of ethical considerations, where did that come from? And, you know, really, what as Catholics should we be looking at when we're looking at kind of considerations of right and wrong?
Well, I think the first thing we want to look at is, I think of consent, right, is I'm agreeing to something or disagreeing with something. Either giving my consent, I'm agreeing with what that certain action, or I'm disagreeing with it and withholding my consent. And so what would that entail? Well, I would say philosophically entails an act of the will. And the act of the will has primacy of place these days, I would say, because we've abandoned objective moral truth. And because there's with the rejection or abandonment of objective moral truth, things that are true independent of my agreeing or disagreeing with them, then we're left with simply choice, consent, and autonomy. My will is, and this is where Nietzsche pointed us, right? Friedrich Nietzsche pointed us to that at the end of the day, without objective moral standards, without objective moral truth, then it's simply going to be me exerting my will using power over and against you. And then you push back, if you can, against my will. And so that's what we're left with. We're left with consent. We're left with, raw acts of the will, ungoverned by the intellect, and our passions have run away with us. There's McIntyre will point us to another feature called emotivism that has to deal with, a primacy, a disordered primacy of place of our emotions in our deliberation in thinking through moral action.
Right. And you've mentioned the name of McIntyre. Actually, I guess I was the one that
you were first.
I was first.
So, which I'm glad you did, because he's super valuable in this conversation.
He's very important because he kind of traces, I think, a history of the collapse of ethical thought from the way people used to think mm-hmm. about ethics, which was, you know, if you read Aristotle, if you read, say, Thomas Aquinas, the first thing you notice is they're really prone to talking about ethics in terms of virtue. They're prone to talking about it in terms of, you know, I guess, the direction towards happiness.
Yes.
Notions that we don't talk about right and wrong like that anymore. We talk about them in terms of right and wrong. And, you know, it's been pointed out. It was pointed out before McIntyre. It was G.E.M. Anscombe, another very important Catholic philosopher.
Indeed.
And she pointed out that when you put that word moral before the word wrong, it's completely 100% utterly meaningless. So if I say, and I think she's completely right about this.
Tell us why.
If I say, okay, going and stealing is wrong, you know, stealing from the gas station, that's wrong. But then I add the word moral before it. Stealing from the gas station is morally wrong. I haven't changed that sentence one iota, right?
Oh, and, I see.
And,
yeah.
And so the word moral before the word wrong has no bearing. So
it's like calling someone a single bachelor.
Right.
Right. It's already, I think those are enthymemes.
Well, I think more to her point, the word moral is just simply empty. So, you know, there is no value to the word moral at all.
Anymore.
Right. And that didn't used to be the case, but anymore.
Generally speaking, right. That's her position.
And so, you know, yes. Back in the 1950s, she kind of called for a moratorium on any continued ethical thinking because she was watching the way that ethics was done at her time by a group that had fallen into consequentialism. So consequentialism is really trying to judge and decide what's right and wrong based on the end consequences of what that action is going to bring about. So, you know, it's utilitarianism, you know, writ large, I think is
right,
probably the,
right. Yeah. The we will sometimes call it, you know, if you think of like, desired outcomes.
Right.
Right. If it produces the desired out, if the action produces, the desired outcomes, then it's good. It's good. Our moral assessment of it would be that it's good. And of course, for Catholics, that's going to be highly problematic,
right? Exactly.
Because it dispenses with any sort of reference to an evaluation of suitable means to achieving desired outcomes or ends.
And you know, Margaret Anscombe, being the nice, polite English woman that she was,
she was quite a character.
She was quite a
She's
character.
She's worth
yes.
looking up, listeners.
Right?
And
exactly.
Seeing she had some eccentricities, and married to another great Catholic thinker too, Peter Geech.
Yes,
was another. Yep. Prominent Catholic philosopher at the time.
But nonetheless...
She was the first. I'm going to throw one little trivia out there. I understand she... So she was teaching at Oxford, and she was the first female professor to actually wear pants.
Yes, yes, exactly. And
so think of outlandish,
right.
how cutting edge that is.
And my understanding is she went to a particular establishment. And
a bar? A pub?
You know, I don't know if it was a bar, a pub, a restaurant, or if it was something else. But anyway, they told her that, you know, women at this establishment do not wear pants. And so she offered to take them off. But anyway, that's... But anyway, yeah. she and her very polite English... subtle fashion made the statement that all moral philosophers at her time showed signs of a deviant mind because of the way moral philosophy was done. You know, basically, and it still is, I think, to a great extent, unfortunately, done this way in a lot of ethics classrooms. The idea is to take what we think is a moral absolute, what we think is a moral rule, and find all the exceptions to how we can break that rule. So the idea of ethics is really to try to find the exceptions to show that, well, even these moral rules don't apply. And she's exactly right. If you do ethics, and if that's the idea of ethics, then that does kind of show a sign of a deviant mind, and you've got to be a little bit of a moral deviant even to start engaging in that process.
And that's so common these days when we think about whether it's ethical issues or say very difficult, say political issues, in that we'd like to immediately bring up the hard cases, the exceptions, and use those to say, well, the, you know, to invalidate the rule. And the analogy I use is learning to get your driver's license. So you're learning the rules of the road and those sorts of things. Well, you immediately learn the value. You should be taught the value and the understanding of following traffic light signals. So knowing what red light means and yellow and green, et cetera. And that's not to, and that we ought to, yellow is caution because it's about to turn red and we need to stop for the safety of ourselves and others because we share the roads with other drivers. Well, with that being said, it would be wrong in teaching driver's ed to immediately go as the instructor and say, look, traffic lights, look, you're going to run red lights because there are rare cases in which you have to get to the hospital for an emergency with someone in your car. And by beginning with sort of giving reasons why one ought to ignore red lights is the wrong way to teach new drivers.
And I have a red light to throw at you right now because we need to take a break here on the Catholic Cave. We'll be back with more right after this.
Most of us like to keep up on what's going on in the world and try to catch a little news each day. Did you know that you can catch the very latest Catholic news right on our website? We have news from Rome, from around the world, and here at home, updated every day so you always know what's going on from a Catholic perspective. Check it out. Go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and look for the Catholic news headlines. There's always something new at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Ready, guys? Green light, Go.
Well, very good. We've been talking about ethics because honestly, when you look at the headlines right now are
a lot of bad behavior.
Exactly. They're dominated by sexual assault suits. They're dominated, and it's not just the rich and famous either. I think, you know, we look at Hollywood and all that's going on with Harvey Weinstein. You know, that's now infiltrated into certain journalists that have been fired for behaving badly.
Matt Lauer.
But, you know, there's been a steady stream of school teachers that have been, you know, fired and found. Mm-hmm. And as we were saying, you know, the overriding concern of society, it seems, in these is around issues of consent and not necessarily around the behavior themselves. So we were trying to unpack a little bit of the, I think, ethical background that got us to this point, to where consent seems to be the overriding driving force in deciding what's right and wrong rather than other considerations, etc. So we were just talking about Margaret Anscombe and her observations around ethics, that ethics had deteriorated. I think she kind of played the role a little bit of a canary in a coal mine of kind of, you know, raising the red flag, saying, wait a second, there's something wrong with the way that we've been doing ethics all along. And so she called for a moratorium on any further ethical thought until two things. We could come up with a coherent theory of human action, because she didn't think there was a good coherent theory of how it is we act, why we act, you know, a good solid theory of human action. And the other is that we had an epistemology that kind of caught up to a certain extent with ethical considerations, because she didn't see anything really in the language of philosophy that would allow us to kind of capture right and wrong well. And she was suggesting going back to virtue terms. So rather than talking about right and wrong, we talk about what's courageous and not courageous. And rather than talking about right and wrong, we talk about what's honest and dishonest. And, you know, that only takes us so far. I mean, I think, you know, that's a good starting point to go back to virtue terms, but you need a little bit more than that to get a coherent theory of ethics.
I think that's such an important point that you bring up about, you know, with her writing. This is in the she's bringing this up in the late 1950s. I think maybe 1958. She pens this incredibly important essay outlining the problems that you just shared, Mark. And then think of this. It's just 10 years later that we get Humanae Vitae from Pope Paul VI. That's going to outline again primarily ethical concerns for the laity and what's happening in society. Now, going back to Anscombe for a minute, think about that. 1958, I think for many of us, we think about, especially think about the Catholic Church in America, that's sort of the golden decade, right? The 50s, where there are priests everywhere, right? And the seminaries are overflowing, and there's 100,000 or more, you know, religious sisters and nuns in the United States, and on and on and on. And mass attendance is 90% or something. And so sort of considered, again, sort of the golden age. But already there's warning signs that something is creeping up on us. And then you have in the 60s, you have the sexual revolution that really engulfs the West. And with the recent death of Hugh Hefner, who one might arguably say was the, I would say, diabolical poster child for the sexual revolution himself, brought about so many pathologies into our society. And I don't want to lay it all at his feet alone, but he's clearly one of the top mischief makers. And more than mischief is an understatement of the trouble he caused and the legacy that he left us. But now we have men acting badly and horribly. And we seem to, as you said, we seem to be focused on things like the violation of consent. But even if consent, even if one gives consent, being willing to do something really doesn't necessarily have a bearing on the act itself and the ethical assessment or analysis of the act itself, because as Catholics we know some things are morally evil and ought to be avoided, even if and to consent to an evil. We actually have a word for that, don't we? Sin.
Right, right. And I think part of the backdrop here that we have with all of the sexual abuse and things that are coming to terms is, at this point, we are left only with trying to sort out the issues of the will involved in it. You know, who willfully did it, who didn't willfully do it, who consented, who didn't consent, who has power, who doesn't have power. And we've lost any ability, really, to analyze, I think, the underlying action itself and condemn the underlying action outside of the context of consent. So there's right. No ability within our society to simply say, look, adultery is wrong, and here's why.
Sexual intimacy outside of marriage is wrong. We still hold, I would say it's a tenuous hold, though. We do seem to still hold, though, as a broader American society to age. So we do seem to... maybe not nearly as loudly as we once did, we do still seem to condemn those over 18 who are preying upon those under 18 years of age. But even there, I would say our grip on that important aspect of being mature enough to actually give consent has been weakened dramatically and continues to erode.
Right, because
as sickening as that is.
Yeah, yeah, and the reason why is because all of this, to a certain extent, is based on kind of popular sentiment of what do we kind of collectively find icky versus what do we kind of collectively find okay. And those change over time. You know, there's nothing solid about that whatsoever. I mean, you know, kind of unfortunately, you know, fads come, and if you make ethics and morality based on fads, you're going to have some pretty slippery slopes pretty quickly.
I think the other source of pollution in this whole ethical sphere has been the rampant accessibility and production of and consumption of pornography. I think going back to the Supreme Court case in which the founder of I won't go into all the details, but basically pornography had been given a couple of decades ago through a Supreme Court case, basically been given full stature in our culture as if it were simply another kind of entertainment, as one might choose to, well, I, you know, for entertainment, I might read literature, I might read comic books, or I just might pick up pornography, you know.
Right.
It was given this sort of equal footing and equal, and now it's one of America's largest exports is pornography. So just think how disgusting that is.
Yeah, yeah.
And think of how that's polluting our... So if you're as a consumer of pornography, that has to cloud and disfigure one's ability to reason well about moral issues.
Yeah, I think it's a great example of how impoverished our ability to reason and think about this, because the reason pornography is condemned is because it's exploitive. Yeah, that's kind of the main argument against it. Once again, going back to that issue of consent, going back to that issue of sort of power of the will.
Autonomy.
But there's so much more wrong with it beyond right. just the fact that it's exploitive. But
right.
but yet that really is a society that's about the most that we can say. Well, it's exploitive, and so the argument against it is, well, you know, it's a contractual agreement between those involved. So where's the exploitation?
It's just a form of employment, you know.
Right.
And if you don't like it, it's these tired old arguments, you know. Well, if you don't like it, don't consume it. You
right,
know,
exactly. Once again, it's based upon your consent
and the
consent of your will, whether you consume it or not. And once again, if you look at Humanae Vitae, there's a completely different, I think, ethical standard and a completely different way that we're supposed to look at these things that go far beyond just the issue of consent, of exploitation, of sort of power dynamics within these things. So I guess, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, that unfortunately we as a society, we're left with only kind of one ethical card to play in condemning these things.
Right.
But the church has a much richer vocabulary, a much richer way of looking at these things, and more importantly, very different principles from which the ethical considerations and the way that the church looks at these things, where that comes from. So let's go back to Humanae Vitae a little bit. Where and how does Humanae Vitae, I guess, depart from the way society as a whole looks at these issues?
Well, I'll say one of the prominent features of it that is just, it's rarely questioned, if at all, outside of Catholic circles and even within the sphere of Catholic thought and debate, doesn't come up often enough, and that's contraception. So one of the sort of the blockbuster, I would say, headlines that comes out of the promulgation of Humanae Vitae in 1968 by Holy Father Pope Paul VI of blessed memory, is that contraception is reaffirmed as being intrinsically evil and to be avoided. And so, which was contrary at the time to what many, many moral theologians and laity thought, well, here we're at, that's the time where the birth control pill has been sold to the American public and others as the form of liberation for women, because they're no longer shackled to being some sort of domesticated helpers trapped in their homes with those pesky families and husbands and children, and they'll now be freed to be as sexually permissive and promiscuous as men were supposedly were at that time, but also to escape home life into careers. And here's one of the things, I know we're going to need to take a break here in a second, but here's one of the things to think about. One of the promises of the pill was that women would no longer be financially dependent on husbands, because you would have husbands were the breadwinners, and they would be responsible primarily for bringing in the bulk of the income that the family would then use for householding. So by being freed from children and still being able to be sexually active, they could then enter into the workforce, which all that wound up doing was simply replace the financial dependent that one might have on one's husband to one's employer, because now you're beholden to your employer, because you need to have a paycheck to cover your own expenses.
We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then below that, in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford, along with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Mark, earlier you mentioned virtue language. Now, it's one of those things that historically we've kind of stepped away from in the philosophical world, from what I understand, and the language has kind of been put on the shelf, except within Catholic thought. How is it that we might be able to reintroduce that virtue language and the virtue concepts to kind of battle what we're seeing in the world today?
Right. You know, what virtue language does and what virtue theory does is it gives you a little bit richer vocabulary to talk about ethics, as we've been saying, particularly with pornography. I think pornography is a great example of kind of the problem with modern ethics based so much around the will. You know, the philosophical label for that is voluntarism, right? So there's this whole system of, you know, right and wrong being simply based on what allows somebody's will to express itself versus, you know, something's bad if it constrains somebody's will.
Right.
You know, it's a very impoverished way to look at right and wrong, because you can't condemn something like pornography based on that. You can't condemn something like contraception, right? Contraception, both people are consenting adults. They've entered into a marriage. You know, this is not something
maybe marriage.
This is not something that's imposing something on one, you know, person, you know, kind of against their will or against their consent. Whether so, what would be wrong with contraception? And so then I think that's where a return to talking about virtue in the terms of, well, chastity. You know, yes, there is a concept of chastity even within marriage. What preserves chastity? What are we guarding against? Why is it that there are, I guess, sort of rules that govern aspects of our life that lead us to human flourishing and happiness? All of that gets lost when you bring it all straight down to just the question of, well, you know, is this, you know, with somebody's consent or against somebody's consent?
It goes back, as you mentioned, it goes, you know, back to virtue, which is that the habits of the soul, that the habits of our character, those things that we, through deliberate effort over time, repeatable actions, form us into a certain kind of person. And you've named some of the virtues, and of course, you know, we have the cardinal virtues.
Yeah. Temperance, prudence, fortitude, and justice.
And
right?
Justice. Yeah. Yeah. Which is, of course, the justice is the virtue that Aristotle points to really for society. That,
right.
The best society is the just society. And so without this language of virtues that align with and remind us that we have what? We have a purpose.
I was just going to bring that up. You know, you don't have virtues and you don't have virtue language without them being directed towards purpose,
a goal, an end, a
happiness,
yeah.
Something like that. Where, you know, our modern, you know, honestly, when you talk about purposes, what you're talking about in some ways is narrowing down the range of choices of what people can choose. So, you know, there's almost a contradiction between talking about a directed ethics towards happiness and flourishing and some concept of the purpose of human life with the idea of freedom of choice, freedom of conscience. Those two are almost mutually exclusive.
Yeah, and so this might be a good time to think about, so who sort of picks up this mantle again? Well, I'm gonna mention Saint John Paul II. So, in his writing Veritatis Splendor, he begins to reintroduce virtue. Now, I wouldn't say it's a encyclical on virtue per se, but rather it's his encyclical on Catholic moral philosophy and theology writ large.
Right.
And in that, he writes it as a foil against some of the contemporary errors in the way we've been thinking about ethics and morality. And so that's going to be sort of his response to it, too, to sort of call us back to a proper Catholic understanding of ethics and morality.
Right. And that proper understanding of ethics and morality is based upon the purpose of human life. You know, that if you don't have an understanding of what our purpose is as human beings, it's very hard to say what the right kind of life
right.
you should
yeah.
live and
right.
what the right choices you should make along the way to get there.
Right. Well, things like we begin to have to, you know, explore his understanding, his definition of how he lays out such important concepts and realities like love. It would be interesting to ask some of the men who are in the headlines for these sexual transgressions and maybe even crimes, that to have them to try to understand, like, I wonder what their definition of love is. I mean, do they? I would just be curious. I have no idea what they would say. I just know that in a proper Catholic understanding, we understand love as self-gift to the other, right? It's sacrificial in nature. And it seems, at least based on, again, some of the headlines, it seems quite the opposite was going on,
right?
Got these guys in so much trouble.
Right. But, you know, that understanding of love as sacrificial and self-giving within a covenantal relationship, that central understanding comes from an understanding of human beings, how we're constituted, what we're made for, and ultimately how we're best situated to get there. You know, I think one of the big advantages to a virtue-based system of ethics, whether it's the Catholic system or whether, there are other virtue-based systems out there. I think you can kind of look at the corporate world a little bit, and you wind up with Stephen Covey, habits of highly successful people. There's a certain,
first he had seven, I think he has eight now,
right? Exactly. Yeah. But once again, it really is kind of a virtue based you're talking about what's right and what's wrong based on kind of what characteristics a person needs to practice in order to achieve certain ends and goals. That's almost the textbook definition of kind of a virtue-based system. But it takes it out of the realm of being, it takes ethics out of the realm of being a theoretical science, and it moves it into the realm of what St. Thomas Aquinas characterized as a practical science. In other words, something that's directed towards a certain end. So a theoretical science is like astronomy or chemistry, where you're studying these things for the sake of understanding them, where a practical science is like the science of architecture or the science of medicine. It's directed towards a certain point. We would call them applied sciences. And ethics, really, when you look at it, it's an applied science. It's not a theoretical science. And somewhere along the line, we kind of got that mixed up. And I think that's where we moved away from. And in some ways, I guess that's kind of the beginning of the story. That's where we moved away from virtue to begin with and tried to base it on some form of theoretical reason. And all of those reasons broke down to, because people consent or they don't consent. It all kind of broke down to that theory of the will determines what's right and wrong.
Well, I know, Mark, one of your primary concerns and areas of interest and inquiry is education. So how are, children, young adults, early adults, where is the ethical formation happening?
Yeah. I think that's another great way that virtue ethics, to a good extent, will differ from, some other ethical system, because you can't learn right from wrong. I mean, even that language, learning right from wrong, kind of shows that, right and wrong, this is something that is a theoretical system that you have to apply your brain to and learn. Where virtue ethics as a practical science is something that you practice. It's something that you develop skill at. It's something that over time you get better and better and better at. And developing virtues is exactly that. So the education of how you instill that in a virtue-based system, it's helping kids to practice acting correctly. And so that takes there's a long process of training, of putting them in different situations. And some of that's based on reading. Some of that's based on, exposing them to certain things within the safe environment of literature where they can kind of practice how a good person would act, or they can see how a bad person would act in that situation. And from the safety of being able to read this within a textbook, But the idea is you give them opportunities to practice virtue. Sports and athletics, I think, play a big part of that. And thank goodness we still kind of have a culture where we somewhat recognize that sports are healthy because kids learn to be courageous. They learn to be compassionate. You know, they learn to be responsible. They learn, you know, different virtues that go along with playing sports, and they have an opportunity to practice them and put them into practice. But that's very different than learning right from wrong by sitting down and kind of learning a theory of ethics. And I think that's what we still try to do a lot in our education, of we try to teach kids respect. Well, respect is something that you have to practice. It's not something that can just be taught in a classroom.
Yeah, I think that those are some excellent points. I'm also reminded of the role of like exemplars or role models, we might say in today's parlance, and how important it is to study, say, the lives of the saints, where we can see how men and women, you know, not ordinary men and women, live by God's grace lives of what? Heroic virtue,
right?
And holiness. And those can be great models for us to imitate.
And at the same time, I think it's important to point out who the bad role models are. And,
well, that's pretty easy. Turn on the television.
I was going to say, look at the headlines.
Right.
You know, but, you know, on the one hand, we say it's pretty easy. But on the other hand, you know, as I said, there's a good side to sports. But I think looking at some of the sporting figures for role models of how to live off the playing field, sometimes that falls apart. And so, you know, you can admire a great athlete for the courage they show on the field, for the respect they have for the game, for their skill, for their dedication and hard work, and at the same time have that person be a very poor example of a husband, a very poor example of a citizen. Those kind of bad role models, it's important to kind of point out where somebody's falling down and failing.
We need to take a break, and we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Keep the focus on Jesus this Christmas season.
To remember what Jesus did for me.
To keep my mind focused on the Lord Jesus Christ.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blandford, and we have been discussing ethics. We've been discussing mainly ethical breakdowns, which all of us can very plainly see when we open up the newspaper or listen to the radio, that the headlines these days are dominated by men behaving very, very badly. But part of the problem is that we've really lost the ability as a society to talk about what is acting good and what is acting bad. You know, we can all agree that violating somebody's consent and taking advantage of your situation where you have a certain amount of power over somebody else, I think we all collectively agree that that's awful. But that, at this point, seems to be about the only ethical pronouncements our society is able to make. And the Church, honestly, has called us to a more expansive, a more extensive, almost richer way of looking at issues of right and wrong. So earlier we had brought up Humanae Vitae as sort of the Church's attempt in the modern world to reassert, I think, the Church's way of looking at ethics broadly, but sexual ethics particularly. And, you know, one of the things we were saying is, you know, the Church's ethical system tends to be virtue-based, although, you know, the Church is also informed by the times to a certain extent, but it does tend to be virtue-based. And because of that, it tends to be a practical science. It tends to be more directed at a how-to and the types of skills and the types of traits that you need to develop in order to live a good life, and less as a theoretical, you know, well, this is the study of right and wrong, and so therefore, after considered study, you know, we have come to the conclusion that this behavior is right and this behavior is wrong, which will kind of that tends to break down and not work out quite as well. So looking at Humanae Vitae, where's the starting point? Where is the church beginning that looks a little bit foreign, I think, to modern contemporary eyes?
I think that one quick quote from Humanae Vitae is this one that sticks out to me, which is, love is total. Love is total. And if love is total, that's true, if that statement's true, which I believe it is, then there can't be or ought not to be a holding, a withholding of self-gift one to the other. So Humanae Vitae is going to look at within the context of sacramental marriage, sacramental matrimony between husband and wife, that is the context for where love is total and ought to be complete self-gift one to the other. Therefore, anything that falls short of that would be problematic or maybe even prohibited. So brings up birth control.
Yeah. Well, let's look at marriage for a second, because in the secular context of marriage right now, marriage is completely based around the notion of consent. You know, two consensual adults, they kind of consent, they agree that they want to live the rest of their lives together, and boom, that's a marriage.
Around emotional fulfillment.
Right, right. And as long as we agree that we want to live together, we're married. When we decide we no longer want to live together, well, we can dissolve that marriage. And not only that, but it's not based around any particular, you know, sexual relationship, because really anybody that just consents that they want to love each other, that can make a marriage. So where is the church's understanding of love and marriage? Obviously, the church has a very different conception than secular society on those things. Where does that come from?
Well, I think the primary difference from what you described, the sterility of contemporary marriage as a kind of arrangement among consenting adults, is the orientation towards children. That marriage has kind of a twofold purpose to it, which is the communion between husband and wife, and their mutual flourishing, but also this openness and orientation towards procreation and the rearing of children as a gift, as collaborators in the vineyard, if you would, with God's plan for creation. So that to me would be the thing that's most significantly missing in many people's contemporary understanding of marriage. There's no reference to children as being intrinsically part of what marriage is about.
And I think it goes back to the church's understanding of love as a willing the good of another, mm-hmm. and acting on that. So acting on what you will and desire for the good of another, and whether that's within the context of marriage or not. I think that's something that's very foreign to our contemporary society outside of the church.
Increasingly so. even within the church, right?
Yeah, right.
But it's a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been secular ideas of what love is. And, you know, we're honestly given a duty as Christians to give ourselves for the sake of others. To love others is to give ourselves for the sake of others. And so there's a duty to give yourself for the sake of others, and in a way that's productive, and in a way that produces, and you know, the way human nature is situated, one of the I think common ways that we do that is we give ourselves to the other in a productive relationship for the sake of producing children, producing families, and in some ways we're kind of fulfilling a duty to society by getting married. If you stepped back and you did a survey of college students and said, now, do you have a duty to get married, or do you have a duty to find a vocation of some variety, whether it's marriage or whether it's religious life or the priesthood, is that a duty? I think you would find the vast majority of people would say, no, there's no such duty there.
Yeah. I think it's that we see a lot of, I guess it's my observation that there's a lot of incoherency when it comes to marriage in the current setting here in America, where on one hand we have so-called same-sex marriage, which is by definition sterile, right? People of the same gender can't naturally have children, and you know, there's been tremendous efforts to legalize that, Supreme Court cases, those sorts of things, and then on the other hand, you've never had higher out of wedlock births than you do now. And so on the one hand, we've completely separated the two. We've completely cut, I don't want to say cut marriage in half, that'd be the wrong kind of an analogy for it, but we've really taken a hammer to the bond of matrimony and disfigured it.
Right. And after we've disfigured it, then the contemporary reaction to that is, but we need to try to fix it. So then we start to enter in and start to try to apply technology to this broken situation.
Oh, right.
By bringing in things like IVF.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, ways that people can kind
We'll have artificial wombs before long.
Exactly. So you know, well, we've now split the idea of the unity between a man and a woman in marriage from the act of procreation, and those two just really they can't be split apart. And now that we've artificially split them apart, now we need to reinsert that element back into these kind of broken relationships that we've created.
Yeah, it's a huge problem on a lot of different levels. That's a whole other show, Mark.
Right. It's a whole other show, but it goes back to Humanae Vitae, and it goes back to something that the church saw even back, honestly, before the sexual revolution even got its feet moving, that if you split the unitive and the procreative aspect of marriage apart, you've really broken up the concept of love, and you've really broken up the concept of the purpose of human life, because the purpose of human life, once again, is to give yourself over for the sake of another. That's the example Christ set for us. Mm-hmm. That's the act of love that we see when we start to look at the Trinity. So, you know, that act of love, as it's put together and brought forth in the sacrament of marriage, it's a beautiful thing. It's what we're called to as Christians. To a certain extent, there's a duty to giving yourself for the sake of the other, whether you're doing it through marriage or whether you're doing it through religious life or whether you're doing it through the priesthood. Your vocation is an act of love. And when you lose that, you lose the notion of the purpose of human life. And so, you know, there's a coherent ethical system there behind something that even in modern world looks so strange as, no, contraception messes everything up. That notion's very foreign to
right.
to the idea of, well, everything boils down to a matter of consent.
Right. Well, and it also points to something we've talked about many times here in the Cape, which is, you know, it can be the breakdown of the family. So the family, to me, seems to be the ideal setting from which we would learn upright ethical behavior, where it's the school of virtue, it's the domestic church, and so as the family has continued to disintegrate and find real challenges here in the postmodern world, I think we're going to continue to, unfortunately, that these headlines are the bad fruit of that rather destructive project.
Exactly, because we've that we're now several decades into a project where the idea of an ethical, upright, virtuous man as being held up as something to emulate, and that being at the bottom of the way we bring our children up, the way we educate our children, that's been missing now for several decades. And I think a lot of these men behaving badly that we're seeing in the headlines, for whatever reason, they did not have the example of somebody acting correctly. They had bad examples. Any number of ways that whole moral education went wrong. But it's pretty obvious that somewhere along the way,
it's gone way
something,
wrong.
Something went way, way wrong.
Well, guys, I just want to toss this in because it's something that I was taught years and years ago. And that's the fact that within a marriage, a man's duty primarily is to get his wife to heaven. A woman's duty, with the support of her husband, is to bring the children into heaven. If we can maybe get back to that, having those roles and showing that respect within the family, then that respect will grow outside the family also. And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave this week. Until next time, may God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.